Welcome, Left Reckoning patrons. I'm Matt Lick. As always, with me, David Griscom.
How's it going?
And joining us today, Aaron Kowalski. You will know him as Kowalski from Nebraska, of the Kowalski Family Farms Incorporated. I have the t-shirt that he's wearing. I couldn't find it. My room's a bit of a mess off camera right now. But Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you more in depth. You know, we've benefited from your wisdom very often in the Left Reckoning patron section, the post game, as well as your calls to Majority Report, which are always very sort of existentially haunting in the sort of at a species level. And so I figured we could just have you on here to talk about a number of other things. But you are a farmer. Now, I saw a tweet earlier today about farmers, and I just wanted to share it with you, kind of kick us off here. It's by John Boys. He says, I feel like farmers are constantly aerating soil and growing crops and shit. Is that accurate to your experience as a farmer?
It depends on where you are. Nebraska has what's called like new soil, essentially. So how soil works is it starts out as a big boulder from the mountains, eventually gets weathered into sand, and then gets weathered further into loam. And if it goes far enough, it'll become clay. Nebraska is more of a sandy loam. So out here, no-till practices are probably more common. The further east you go, the more loam, the more clay you're going to come into. And that soil, you'll actually need to aerate. Otherwise, it will become a hard pan. So it does depend where you're at, and there's a lot of variance anyhow. So
there you go, John. with that said, how about take us through your operations? You know, what's your personal history with the farm? On my mother's side, my mom grew up on a dairy farm in southeastern North Dakota. And so I'm curious what your experience is. What do you grow? What have you grown? That sort of thing.
Well, our farm, the one I'm on now, essentially used to belong to my paternal grandmother's side of the family, the Myers, and that used to be a dairy farm. And even during the Second World War, we actually had German POWs working at it. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. That dairy got bought out in the early 70s, and then we switched to just growing corn and raising Angus cattle. Today, most of our operation that we do, like just within our farm, is growing soybeans and corn mostly. And then I have a small number of cattle, not a lot, not what it used to be back in the day, just because anymore you have to have like huge scale to make that work. But the big thing that we have done, my family in particular, because I work with my two older brothers, is we do a lot of custom work either for the co-ops or other farms. So I'll run dry machines for the co-op, or my brothers will run sprayers for them. And then like right now, the place we're waiting to dry out, it's a farmer. He needs more like help. So we're combining, and that pays pretty well. And our farm is not paid off, so the extra income is always really good.
Talk to us about co-ops, because that is something you come across in rural America quite a lot.
So most of the co-ops we're dealing with now, I'm not entirely sure why they can still be called co-ops, because they're functionally just like product distributors now and grain marketing firms. There are some really good local, like farmer owned co-ops, but there has been a lot of consolidation lately in co-ops. They're no longer just all local. Like the one that I'm used to in my town is actually owned by a larger conglomerate, basically based out of a neighboring county. And this thing extends into Texas and Kansas and Iowa. So I'm not entirely sure like what it is that allows them to still be a co-op, since they don't function like you would think a co-op should. But it's a complicated relationship. It's gotten a lot of animosity from new farmers and old farmers, because like a lot of guys remember back in the day, like in the 80s, that You would get like a dividend, basically, if the co-op made any money. They would sell you fertilizer and other inputs like as cheap as could be. And now you're having to like bid and you get better like rates if you buy in bulk, which doesn't make sense because, you know, a co-op is supposed to be everyone's pooling their money anyways. Mm-hmm. So it's really complicated, really. And I don't know, like I said, how to explain that part.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting to me because, like, I hear about electric co-ops in North Dakota. There's a whole bunch of different types of co-ops, and they do just operate a lot. I mean, and this was me as a kid seeing this stuff, but it seemed like just businesses, right? It wasn't until later I understood that, oh, this is supposed to be something different that ideally – but I imagine there's a similar degeneration of co-ops elsewhere. Like, and you say, like, scale. I mean, that seems to be a timeless issue in farming is monopolies coming in.
It's the what is it, the average acres that a farmer used to farm like back when my dad was my age was like close to 400-500, and today it's closer to like 900. A lot of that has to do with like the pay isn't great because every decade or so there's essentially a farm crisis where all the little guys basically lose. And then who's ever still standing buys everyone else out. That can only go on for so long. But, I mean, it's – a lot of it also has to do with the co-ops are all consolidating. All of the distributors, like for agricultural equipment and seed, they're all consolidating down. Like Bayer and Monsanto used to be competitors, and now they're essentially the same thing, which isn't good, and it's happening with a lot of the other seed companies. And, like, they're basically just these giant behemoths, and even the co-ops then aren't really fighting on the farmers' behalf, so... And they're the ones who market all the grain, so they're kind of controlling the price on that end. I don't know if it has to deal with, like, distributors of, like, the fertilizers and the herbicides and whatnot basically influencing the co-ops. Like, if anything, I feel like it's a relationship that way that's kind of poisoning the farmer side of it. And it's a lot of headaches to deal with anymore, just because, like, essentially, even when I was at the university, we're basically taught that farmers are price takers. We don't get to dictate what we buy. You have to have like certain inputs anyhow. And then on the flip side, we have to sell at whatever the market's demanding. And there really isn't anything you can do as an individual farmer. And to overcome that was supposed to be the co-ops, but now they're basically not.
Is there much in the way of pushback that you're seeing right now, or is everyone just sort of sitting back on it?
It's, I would say that a lot of folks are just like, they feel like it's impossible to do anything about it. Because I'll mention, like, you know, co-ops are supposed to be on our side. We're supposed to be the ones, you know, like, making the decision. Like, we don't get to decide on who gets fired, who the CEO gets to be. It's all part of a board now. So it's not, like, a healthy system. And a lot of people are upset about it, but pretty much nobody's doing anything about it. And that's really depressing.
It's really sad, like, because I assume Nebraska, I don't know the history of it as well, but I assume they had similar sort of farmer populism as happened in the Dakotas. And so, like, it's not like that history doesn't exist and there's no model for it, or am I wrong?
No, there is a lot of really good and rich history with, like, farmer cooperatives and, like, communities making collective action and whatnot, because, in Nebraska's public school, in like the fourth grade, you're taught like Nebraska history, you know, what things we accomplished. And some of it is that in like the late 1800s, early 1900s, farmers would collectively get together and they would fight basically the railroads abusing the grain market, because the railroad could just charge the rates. I believe it was basically after essentially threatening to take out a couple locomotives and cripple a rail line that they finally realized you had to do something to keep the farmers happy. And maybe if like the USDA actually cared about the farmers' well-being, but I mean, lately all the guys that have been in charge essentially are either working for the corporate side of the dairy industry or the meatpacking industry, which is never good for farmers, because the cheaper the grain is, the better they're always going to be.
I mean, I just want to note that, you know, they're like, it's been interesting to see the Biden administration, the way that they're playing, for example, the, you know, the kind of increase in meat prices for consumers, but it's been really bad for people who produce cattle because, you know, because there's essentially just been consolidation of the meat industry by a few companies. And it's been interesting to see, because I remember seeing some headlines about the Biden administration was addressing it, but I haven't seen much in the way of like any material attempts to sort of push back against the, you know, the price setting that these conglomerates are able to push on, you know, on local farmers across the country.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem that we're seeing. So when it comes to like cattle, as far as I can tell with the market lately, what farmers are selling to feedlots and what feedlots are selling cattle for hasn't really moved much. Which is kind of a problem because inputs are going up. Feed is going up just a little bit, and then labor is going up just a little bit. There isn't that much money in cattle to begin with. But
and it takes a while, too.
It does take a while. But another issue I do know with like international markets right now is that there was a pretty big swine epidemic in China. China's the largest pork producer and consumer in the world. And when that occurred, they had to wipe out something like half of their entire hog supply. They're in the process of rebuilding it, which means they're going to need more feed. But during that time, they didn't need as much feed and they needed more imports. So it really did disrupt a lot of things. So like, as far as agriculture has been concerned, it's been dealing with these major epidemics for like over a decade now, because every so often, like, tens of thousands of birds also have to get wiped out when there's like a major epidemic in either like the barns that make eggs or the barns that make, you know, like the actual chickens that you'll eat in the, that come from the store. But like, it, as far as these monopolies go, I don't really think anybody's doing anything substantial about it, because what we were hearing about a decade ago was that we needed to have labeling to show that, you know, like meat was from the United States. That way you could track the beef down, because I believe Brazilian meats making it into the American market, if they get slaughtered here, it can be labeled made in the USA. And it was some sort of a controversy back then that never really went anywhere. It just seemed like a marketing gimmick for people running for office, which appears to be like the number one thing coming out of politicians in this region of the country anyways. So
yeah, I mean, there's a few things I want to talk about from that. I mean, so we were talking before we got on, start recording about, you know, how tied to the weather you are. And like we recording today, cause you're letting the field dry off a little bit today. What's been your experience of like ecological awareness? Cause I that's something I sort of, I sort of have a nostalgia for like the farm report, listen to that, like on the, in the morning, like on the farm, like that sort of thing where you hear like what the weather's going to be like, tell us about your experience and like also bring in climate change into it too.
Yeah. So basically our entire, like outside of winter, pretty much our entire daily activities is dictated by whatever the weather's going to be. Nebraska is slightly drier than like the rest of the Midwest. It's actually kind of strange because like you can tell Midwestern culture extends into Nebraska just solely off of the river valleys where you can actually, you know, have good farms because everything else is pasture. But I think the mindset with farmers is they're a little more conscious of like how rain and weather has been impacting them. And with climate change, we're not entirely sure how that's going to play out yet. A lot of forecasting that I've seen, and I've had professors at the university also make this claim, Nebraska is supposed to see a slight uptick in the amount of water it's going to get, along with like the Great Lakes region. I believe that's what most people are thinking. And it has to deal with like how moist air comes over the Rockies from the Pacific. There'll be slightly more evaporation and there'll be a little bit more rain. The problem with that is that our infrastructure isn't built for more rain. So we're going to have like stronger levees, more reuse pits, that sort of thing, which won't be terrible. But, you know, like you got to start laying that groundwork now, because a lot of this is just going to happen. Even if you could go carbon zero tomorrow, the momentum of a lot of this is happening no matter what. And no one's really making plans for that. I would say amongst younger people, there's definitely a greater awareness of it. But even talking to a lot of older folks, like my neighbor, who's like 89 and still climbs up into a tractor and combine, which is insane to me. He said that like the last 15 years has been some of the craziest weather of his life. In 2012, we had the worst drought basically in the nation's history. And then in 2019, we had the worst flood in living memory. And that all occurred within a 10-year period. And like it batters your infrastructure severely. And when you're dealing with something as delicate as the food supply, if you don't have hardened infrastructure for that, a failed crop is something we haven't really dealt with in the United States since the year without a summer. And something like that occurring here again would be just catastrophic to the globe. Not because like we're going to starve, but because we're a massive global exporter. Like America is like a huge like link in the global supply chain of food. And our disruption would be catastrophic. It just wouldn't be like something you could even conceive. So it's really frustrating that like any person could see all of this and pretty much nobody's really doing much about it. Like, I'm not really sure like what politicians in your guys' areas talk about with any of this, but like out here, most of the people in charge don't really talk about climate change because either A, they know the voters aren't really going to care, or B, don't know enough to actually come up with any common sense policy to like make it into a practical thing. So like there are things you could easily do. And like I have had plenty of great professors who have talked about it, and plenty of people who have like worked at the co-ops and stuff who are older who have seen like programs in the past that have been pretty decent, but like pretty much nobody believes any of this stuff is just going to happen anymore.
Yeah, it's depressing. I mean, that's that thing about your neighbor is very interesting, because it is interesting to hear the impressions of old timers and just them corroborate what like the science is telling you. Like, this is very strange as far as weather patterns go.
Yeah, he said that the flood we had in 2019 wasn't anything he's experienced since about the mid-50s.
Wow.
And back then, the only reason that flood was worse was because the town where I live, basically part of the town would flood like every 5 years or so. So the city spent, and whoever the civic planner was for this is probably telling I told you so to everybody, but basically our area of Nebraska got hit with like a 500-year flood, and it didn't even scratch the city. Like our flood diversions and everything pretty much parried it just fine. All the neighboring towns got just hammered. Basements were flooded and collapsing in. Riverbanks were overflowing. It was a disaster, which just shows that a little bit of foresight can save you so much money in the long run, but nobody wants to do it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, that's my experience in Fargo going to college there. It's like, 3 years of the five that I went to undergrad, we missed extended periods of time to go volunteer to help sandbag the Red River. And, you know, now they're trying to get some sort of increased levee system upriver. They've done it in Grand Forks and, you know, Winnipeg and stuff like that. But like, it's just, I guess we have this giant college student population in Fargo. We'll just depend on them.
Utilize them when we need them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's frightening. I mean, here you have one, the big threat of, you know, water scarcity coming, and two, more extreme weather hitting places that aren't prepared to deal with, you know, cold winters and even hot summers. And, you know, all we're really seeing so far is rules about how much green energy we can use, even though that had nothing to do with the power outages here, and like a big boom in you know, battery power for houses. And it's the most, I'm sorry, it's like the most conservative Texas kind of solution to like a collective problem, right? It's like, my house is going to have power, fuck everybody else, instead of coming up with, you know, serious weatherization of the grid. Yeah, It's certainly worrying.
And I mean, like, just a simple regulation in Texas would have probably prevented that entire blackout, because Nebraska's wind turbines were still spinning. It was 20 degrees colder here than it was in Texas. We have heaters. It's standard.
It was natural gas that was the biggest
natural gas lines froze up in Texas. But I also read somewhere that a couple of even the coal fire plants weren't able to load the coal up because the wheel loaders they were using had diesel engines, and they had not had anybody who have ever dealt with diesel fuel gelling over before. So they were contacting mechanics like, what the hell do you do about this? The simplest solution, 5% mixture of just gasoline. Won't gel up. That's literally what every tow truck driver around the area here will tell you. It's like the simplest solution, just a gallon of gas mixed with like 50 gallons of diesel. It works every time.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's true. Like, there are, I mean, obviously, like, on the macro level, we need to be pushing to lower our emissions. But there are, you know, just simple fixes that we can do to make sure that, you know, as crises do come in the near future, they don't, you know, sort of explode into the worst, you know, the worst possibility. But there really is, I don't know, there's a political refusal, and I think also in some places, unfortunately, a cultural refusal to really start prepping for what we need to be doing.
I feel like a good chunk of that mindset stems from the farm crisis in the 1970s, because something I've noticed is that farmers do tend to think a bit more collectively, because it's a little more structured in a lot of ways. But ranch culture always pushes up against like farm culture in a lot of ways, because when you think of ranchers, you think of like cowboys out on, you know, the prairie, you know, mavericks out in the wilderness, you against everyone else. Mm-hmm. Farming doesn't really work like that. We kind of have a history of having to band together whenever the Vikings show up, because, you know, if you don't, pretty much your whole irrigation systems get wiped out, your roads get wiped out, everything does. So during the farm crisis of the 70s, ranchers didn't get hurt as bad as...
Could you explain that, the farm crisis of the 70s, for folks who aren't familiar?
Oh, boy. this is... So in the late 70s, what basically triggered it was the Department of Agriculture wanted farmers to plant from fence row to fence row, maximize every acre you could to pump as much corn out as possible, because the Soviet Union was going through a drought, and they were our number one importer for a little while. For whatever reason, when nobody thought about it, basically, when they invaded Afghanistan, we hit them with an embargo, and then they embargoed us for the corn. So we ended up having a massive glut of corn. The solution to that was to give farmers money to store the corn, to not actually cut production. That ended up creating like this massive, massive surplus. And the price of corn went from, if you factored for inflation and purchasing power, to like the highest it ever was at close to like $9 a bushel in today's dollars, down to about $2. This was also at the same time, interest rates were incredibly high. So like your operating note, you would have like 15 to 20% operating notes from a year to year, like just, you know, you're spending on seed. And it worked out really well for the guys who had savings accounts, but a lot of farmers ended up basically getting annihilated because they were over leveraged. At the time when people were making a lot of these decisions, though, you can justify a lot when there's $9 corn, but when it's $2, you're pretty much screwed. What ended up actually ending it was under the Reagan administration, who promised to not bail out farmers, immediately bailed out farmers. It was like the largest like stabilizing effort since the Great Depression. Pretty much nobody sees it that way, but they essentially just threw money at the problem, basically CRP. They pulled a lot of ground out of production, and eventually the glut died down. It's a little more complicated than that, but they essentially paid farmers not to plant crops, which got the glut of grain to go down. And that pretty much stabilized it. So that's what a lot of people were really wanting to happen back in like 2017, when the price of corn basically plummeted again for a similar reason. the trade wars and whatnot, there was just, mm-hmm. you know, a glut of corn. And the easiest thing to do to stop that would have been to just give farmers money to not plant, since it was something that was proven to have worked before, just didn't get implemented. And it's kind of, farmers can get very conspiratorial, and it's because we basically don't have any control over any of it. Mm-hmm. But the most, like, logical thing we can all assume is that basically Trump's agricultural secretary didn't really care that corn was cheap, because that would mean cheaper beef, which means the meatpacking plants could buy beef at a cheaper cost. And since they don't have any competitors, they can sell it at pretty much whatever they want. So, like, the cheaper the grain, the better it is for meatpacking plants. So it stands to reason that he wouldn't have cared if farmers were suffering.
This is a president who invited, like, college football teams to eat Big Macs in the White House. So I think that I love the beef.
Yeah. Not that, like, even most of the beef, I believe, through McDonald's is basically old dairy cows. And
that's so sad.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Should we put up this big fancy land use map? See what we can observe there, and talk about maybe how we could imagine the future of farming a little bit. This is a lot of data we're seeing here, but as somebody who has played a lot of Microsoft Flight Simulator, I'm basically aware of all this sort of thing. So, Kowalski, what do you observe when you see this?
So, if you look around, you'll see that, like, pasture and rangeland definitely is, like, the biggest thing you will see here, followed up closely by cropland. And if you look at where these two, like, areas are located, most of the rangeland is located in areas that are sparsely populated, have poor soil, and have less rainfall than, say, eastern part of the United States. From the tip of Texas, and if you go basically draw a straight line north from that, west of that line there is much less rainfall than east of that line. That means you cannot grow as many crops for, like, agricultural use. Basically, you're just going to end up with hardy grasses. That's why it's essentially a big open pasture. There are areas, particularly more towards the north, that you'll have forests, you know, Yellowstone. You can clearly see that up in Wyoming. But, I mean, essentially that area has always had ranging animals out on it. Historically, buffalo, today cattle. It'd be nice to see it go back to buffalo. The beef is, or the meat from buffalo is actually better and less damaging to the environment. They're just built like tanks and hard to control. But a lot of people always talk about how we need to get away from meat-based proteins and towards plant-based proteins, which I fully agree. They are better for the environment. The problem is that you can't just supplement this pasture land to grow, you know, almonds, to grow your legumes that you need for protein. Because when it comes to a plant-based diet, you have to have all the plant proteins to make up for all the proteins you get out of meat proteins. I think there's 14, and no plant has all 14, but any form of meat will have all these, and you need them for good health. Currently, most of our vegetables are grown in Southern California and Arizona. Most of that is all irrigated from the Colorado River, a river that is seeing historic drought. The western part of the United States is going to get drier and hotter, particularly towards the south. The eastern part of the United States might not get drier, but it's also going to get hotter. Our best bet moving forward would be to just invest in greenhouses, particularly around, like, the Great Lakes region, because that's also where there's a lot of people. And if there's a lot of people, there's a lot of workers, and those folks can work in greenhouses. I also have to say, going in a greenhouse in January is actually a pretty appealing recreational thing. So there's a lot of practical uses for it, and it would also make us far more secure. Historically speaking, any society that had a lot of beef or like shepherds were always safer than those solely dependent upon crops, because in the event of a massive natural disaster, whether it be like a huge volcanic eruption leading to a year without a summer, or, you know, like a low grade or like a minor meteor strike or something that would disrupt the environment, greenhouses would be very safe because, you know, you could supplement the energy, you could still grow the food. Cattle were really good to have as well, because grass is a really hard plant to kill. It can grow in really tough environments.
Mm-hmm.
And worst case scenario, you can always slaughter the dairy cows and hope, you know, that spring will come eventually. So like meat has always been a safe bet because you can also store it for a very long time. It's a lot harder to do that with vegetables. And if you look at that map, cattle is spread all over the place. So even if you had like a drought in Texas, you're still going to have lush grass up in Montana, or, one natural disaster isn't going to wipe all that out. California is also risky for another reason, and it's earthquakes. Supply chains can get disrupted pretty easily. A few roads getting knocked out, a few levees breaking, a few dams breaking, and the Central Valley could... giant fires or mudslides. Everything seems to be hitting there. It would make a lot of sense for us to just invest in a lot of greenhouses, spread them across the breadth of the Republic, and then the produce is also locally sourced at that point as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it would just simply make it safer and likely cheaper, and you would have, you know, locally sourced produce, while at the same time there could be, you know, some sort of recreational aspect to it, because you would have all these greenhouses that would be nice and warm in the middle of winter, and people enjoy that kind of stuff. So, I mean, in my like idealistic future, every county seat or like, you know, the larger communities would have these greenhouses around them. They would all be like owned by the county or like some sort of countywide cooperative effort, and people would work at it. You would have all this locally sourced food, and I'm sure places like New York would never be able to produce enough for themselves. You'd sell your surplus off to them, and it would be fine. But if you continue to just grow all of our like vegetables and trees down in Southern California, first off, the water is not going to last forever. The environment's probably going to become unsuited soon, and we're probably on the verge of seeing the insect migration as climate change starts pushing the heat further north. Another thing that I do want to bring up with, like, on Majority Report yesterday, you guys had on the guy who was talking about, resistant weeds, you know, like weeds that are resistant to glyphosate and stuff like that. A lot of that has to do with the southern part of the United States not having a hard freeze. Winter is basically, like, a natural way of eliminating a lot of bugs and a way to like stop fungus and stuff like that, which is one of the reasons why the United States is a lot better at growing crops than say Brazil, who doesn't get hard freezes. Like the Amazon freezes, we're screwed. But it's basically like a cheap pesticide that we just get, which is awesome to have. If that continues to weaken, though, and we start getting spring earlier, then we're going to start ending up with like fungal diseases this farther north, and that's going to be a lot harder to control. So even supplying the necessary feed for cattle might become problematic in the future, just because you could have a disease wipe out, you know, like a county's worth of grain. Greenhouses are great. You can shut them off from the outside environment. You don't want insects in them. You shut the door. You screen up the ventilation. It's an easier environment to control, which would make it safer. So like in an ideal future moving forward, having more control over like locally sourced food, I just view that as like a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone doing these greenhouses? That sounds, I mean, that sounds
the Netherlands.
Like a future. Okay. Interesting.
It's in Northern Europe, there are a lot of greenhouses. Interestingly enough, by value, the three biggest agricultural exporters, I believe, is the United States, Brazil. Makes sense. We're huge countries.
Right.
And then it's the Netherlands.
Wow.
That, you know, that's fascinating. Because yeah. I went to Amsterdam, and I remember on the bus, like, looking out, and they had a whole bunch of, like, crazy farm shit in the countryside mm-hmm. there. It's, mm-hmm. That shit was impressive.
I mean, they're very prepared for...
Right, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, the greenhouses and also all of the dams.
It's there's a lot we could actually learn from, like, the lowlands up there, because another issue we have right now is, like, monoculture, which is a whole nother animal. And honestly, it's probably going to be a dead end at some point, because it's essentially we're just planting clones of plants. So once there's some sort of disease that, you know, like blight that can just wipe out a corn crop, you're probably going to have to, like, almost resort back to, like, slash and burn methods just to protect things. So, like, my whole view is that greenhouses are good because they're safe, secure. You also use, like, 90% less water in them because you control their humidity. So, like, just in every way, greenhouses are better. But, like, one thing that we could do that I would like to see is basically using all the freed up land for, like, carbon sequestering. Because as I think I've said it to you guys before when talking in your Discord thing, is if we were to just collect the biomass of a lot of plants and put it somewhere to where those plants can't decompose, that's pulling carbon out of the air. It's not a, you don't need, like, fancy technology to, you know, pull carbon out of the air and put it into blocks or something. You could literally just grow a field of forage crop, bale it up, send it down the Mississippi or the Missouri River down to the Gulf, submerge it under the water, blast sediment on top of it with a dredge, all technology we currently have, and you would be sequestering tons and tons of carbon. You would expand wetlands out on the Gulf, which would protect coastal areas from floods, while at the same time you're sequestering carbon. Farmers get paid everywhere throughout the country, so they're going to be happy. People moving, it's going to be happy because transportation jobs, and the guys out on the coast will be happy because wetlands also purify rivers. So when all of the poison that gets dumped into the Missouri or the Platte or the Mississippi or the Ohio, when it all gets to the Gulf, it creates massive dead zones. In fresh water, I believe it's phosphorus creates algae blooms. In the salt water, it's nitrogen that creates algae blooms. Completely destroys your fishing industry. So all of this, like, in an idealistic future, that is where I would like to see us moving towards, because it's working in, like, a more symbiotic relationship with nature instead of, like, trying to push against the wind. Just use it.
Yeah, and protect our good shrimps and shit like that too.
I want to talk about small towns with you, Kowalski. And, you know, as we talk about our utopia of, you know, returning the up Midwest to the Buffalo, for instance, and also, I think, you know, assessing treaty lands with regards to, like, land back claims like that. But I want to talk about, like, small towns. I spent a lot of summers in Hankinson, North Dakota. My impression is generally rural areas, rural towns are shrinking. I'm curious, like, what is the future for these towns? Like, because I feel like they are forgotten by the political classes. Like, there's, if there were, like, if the Lakota and Dakota were more of a threat, we would be giving the people broadband, I think, at this point. But, like, they're not anymore, so we don't really worry about it, right? Like, what's your sense of, like, the future of the small town in America?
So, I believe if you look at a map. Or if you looked up the demographics of all of Nebraska's counties, most of the counties' populations peaked in the 1930s. So I think there's about 90 counties in Nebraska. Only about 12 of them have actually seen their population increase since the 1930s. So even though our population's gone up, it's only been in one area. The areas are also aging rapidly. So, it probably isn't good if we maintain the status quo, but I don't know, aside from, like, some sort of incentives, like, one of the ideas, like with the whole greenhouse thing, is that like you could go to a county seat, which is typically in the middle of a county, which is usually about a 30 by 30 mile area. And that would at least give you some sort of like economic and cultural heart to the area that you could, you know, prosper in.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of areas that don't have like the county seat of, you know, because every county seat has a courthouse, they have a post office, they have to have some sort of administrative aspects, which is basically just the state flooding resources into an area that's just consuming resources and not really giving anything back. There'll probably always be a few people, but like, unless some sort of like major investment is made, I don't really think there is much of a future in small towns. Like, I'm pretty fortunate. My small town is Grand Island, which is a big small town because it's got like 50,000 people.
Right.
It's a transportation hub. It's a small manufacturing area. It's got a couple grain elevators and it sits on the junction of two major rail lines. So like that town will always be fine. But if you go a little bit further to the north, pretty much all these towns are shrinking. Mm-hmm. And no matter how you slice it, pretty much cattle is not going to have much of a future because plant-based meats, whether it's going to be lab-grown, which it's, I'm not too sure about that being a thing anytime soon, but even the plant-based ones, like, have you guys ever had the Impossible Whopper from Burger King?
Yeah.
I haven't, no. I should, but I haven't.
I've had it, and, you know, I think it tastes just as terrible as any other burger from Burger King.
I think that's fair.
Because the thing is that, like, fast food makes up a pretty good chunk of, like, pretty cruddy beef. Mm. And if you can replace that with a plant-based alternative that's half the cost, that's, like, a quarter of the entire beef industry dead. And that right. means that there is essentially no profit margin left for ranchers or for feedlots.
Mm.
And feedlots have also been consolidating down, which is dangerous because instead of having the manure and whatnot spread out across an entire county, it's concentrated in one area, which is going to destroy the groundwater at like the very least, let alone like, you know, potential biological contaminants of having that many feces and that many animals living in close proximity to people. So I don't really see there being much of a future for cattle, which is why something needs to be done that would change that. And personally, I think a lot of like ranching areas are essentially just going to become vast stretches of wilderness with free range animals and will be basically a glorified hunting ground, which wouldn't necessarily be a terrible thing, but I mean, The bad part is that all of the people who are going to lose their homes and their jobs and all their opportunities and whatnot.
And their culture and community, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, we need to start thinking about a just transition for this in addition to, like, fossil fuel stuff, I think.
It's like the same dilemma with the coal miners. Like, coal is done. It doesn't have a future. It's going to linger there for a while, but I mean, like, it's not going to grow. It's not going to, you know, revitalize anything. And cattle's pretty much the same way. It's, I believe, like, cattle, what was it? Like, there's something about the beef industry in the United States peaked in, like, the 70s. And we've slowly been moving towards poultry because it's cheaper and easier to do. And you can do it in more populated areas anyhow. So, like, beef doesn't have a future. So moving forward, what are these areas going to do? Without having some sort of outsized like program, they're doomed. But I mean, there's a history of things that you could do. Like from the Depression, we know like the Conservation Corps, it could employ a lot of people. The carbon sequestering things, like the best thing I can come up with because it targets like an immediate need and it doesn't really reinvent the wheel. It's utilizing the equipment and tech that we already have. So like, there are things that could be done, but I don't think a lot of the people in a position to do anything really want to do anything about it. And even like the people, like Nebraska has the governor race coming up, and the guys that are running, they don't really know anything about agriculture. They don't think of any of these issues as a thing. The one's running on CRT and the other one's running on how he was almost Trump's ag secretary pick. So, like, basically,
Trump, we have a expert on agriculture.
Yeah, and we basically have a freight train of destruction heading our way, and everyone's concerned with the town gossip. So, I'm not entirely sure what our long-term prospect is, but hopefully, if enough people get angry about it, maybe we can get some people in a position of power. But like, my whole thing always comes back to, it's going to take some sort of outsized like impact from like, the state could probably do it on their own, but we probably need to have a federal program to transition, because it's just simply going to be too big of a problem for individuals to handle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't know who's going to do that, because there aren't many politicians really talking about solutions. Like the whole climate summit, everyone's talking about the problem. Great. We know it's a problem. We knew it was a problem in the 80s.
Yes. Well, on that note, Kowalski, you had for briefly, at least, trying to infiltrate the Republican Party from the left. Do you have any updates for us on that endeavor?
So right now, I am still strongly considering running for state Senate, predominantly using what I'm talking about now as my main message for it. Because I think as long as you can explain the problem well and have a solution for it, you could probably bring people on board. Mm-hmm. And the person that is running on the Republican side, and there's no Democratic challenger because of how our district is made up, I could probably beat him on ag issues. The issue that I know I would face is whether or not you could actually convince any of the other senators to actually do anything. Mm. Because the weird thing is there's basically three groups in Nebraska. There's rural Republicans, which are okay. There are urban Republicans, which are essentially just corporatists. Like, they mm-hmm. toe the national party line. They talk about, you know, whatever the DC think tanks are talking about, i.e. every rural or every, you know, governor from the Midwest.
Right.
And then you've got your Democrats, who honestly aren't much different than the Republicans, except they do talk a little nicer. But none of them have really been all that impressive either, except for like a few mayors. There aren't really that many strong Democrats on it. So like, sure, I could run and I could maybe win, but even if I get there without like going full LBJ and just intimidating everybody with violence, I'm not really sure how you could get anywhere with it.
Yeah,
that and the solution that I have is also technically a temporary one, because the carbon sequestering thing, if you do the numbers, you would essentially be back to pre-industrial carbon levels if the United States basically forced the whole planet to go with our model, which would be fine, like environmentally wise. It would be one good thing we could do with this dying empire. In like 50 years, we could be at carbon. We could be back to like 1800s level of carbon concentration in the atmosphere. The oceans will still get warm. They'll still rise a bit, but like it would be stable at the very least. Beyond that, there wouldn't be really anything else to do. And the model of getting there is essentially building like a carbon stock exchange, which to sell that would basically be like Omaha needs to be the carbon like market of the planet. You know, everybody buys carbon credits from there, and somehow we pay for it probably with some sort of carbon tax. That has a whole bunch of other issues with it, and frankly, I think at that point you would start to lose people.
Yeah, so, you're gonna need to get Warren Buffett to do it himself.
that is the amount of people that give him such like good graces makes no sense to me. He's always like, oh, my personal income tax is, you know, just as bad as my secretary. We should change that. What would it matter? You get all your money from like stocks. It's all capital gains. Of course you don't care if your income tax goes up. And it's such a sham too, because like it's so much of the politics side of it is very frustrating. And talking with so many of these people, like I've talked to our state senators, I've talked to the lieutenant governor, I've talked to our secretary of state. And it's strange to talk to somebody who's essentially just a hollow person. Like there's nothing there.
Yeah, that is all freaky.
It is bizarre. Like, what are your passions? Just like watching paint dry or watching, you know, somebody get thrown into jail. Like, I don't know what these people do. Like, I don't even understand, like, what their passion could possibly be because they don't seem to have any, like, fire or, like, drive to do anything worth doing. It's just, I want to be in a position of power to be in a position of power to for what I don't know.
Yeah. It's almost like they've just flowed there, like the same way people flow into like a job in IT and not really give a shit about computers or something like that.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And like our Secretary of State's talking about like the voter fraud stuff. And I've talked to him. He's a smart guy. He knows it can't be true. Doesn't care. Doesn't care that it's probably going to get somebody. It's going to end up getting some county clerk beat up. Because they're going to be like, well, of course this wasn't, you know, fraud. I wouldn't even know how to, you know, to disrupt this election. Like, I don't even think there's a way you could do it. And then somebody's going to get angry about it. And I don't think they really care that they're exacerbating the problem.
That's where the Democrats, they're going to do their voter fraud is in Nebraska. They're going to flip Nebraska. Don't they have like a weird, don't you have a weird thing where you split your electoral college votes anyway?
Yes. If you win the majority of the state, you get the two Senate votes. And if you win the majority of a district, you get that district's electoral vote.
Mm.
It wouldn't be a bad system nationally because then you wouldn't have swing states anymore. You would only have swing districts, which would make it a bit more competitive.
Yeah.
Though that's when gerrymandering would become very important.
Oh, I bet. You're right.
It would. Nebraska, it doesn't have a problem with gerrymandering because we've only got the three districts. And
North Dakota's got one.
Yeah. Omaha is by itself. Lincoln and a couple surrounding communities are by itself here. And then the rest of the state, which is bigger than Pennsylvania, is its own district. So, yeah, the states are really big out here, but there's no one.
On that note, Aaron Kowalski, Prairie Fire on YouTube, folks, go subscribe. I haven't checked back recently, but I did really enjoy the look into the grain elevator and some of the other stuff you were doing there. You got any plans for the future?
Yeah, I'm hoping to start to do some like review stuff just because of the like trying to have a more rural perspective on some things. Like, I feel like having maybe an actual country person review some of those Prager videos would be kind of hilarious.
That would be awesome.
People love that stuff. People love the reaction stuff. I think you're right on with that.
Yeah, I just need to have a little more optimistic tone. Like I said, my throat's a little burning today from that whole grinder thing, but I was working in the shop earlier, just in case
Kowalski, people love your delivery, man. You'll do great.
Oh yeah. And then I'm hoping to make some videos to explain the whole carbon sequestering thing, because again, it in my mind, I've always been easier to it's always been easier for me to understand things in like a visual form or listening as opposed to like reading something. I don't know if that means I'm on the spectrum or something, but it's how I've learned, and I think it's a better way to explain things. So I'm hoping to do that soon. Just harvest has gone on much longer than it was supposed to because we keep getting all this extra work because there aren't that many farmers now, and there are a lot of older farmers who, frankly, cannot go as long and get tired. So, yeah, not there sure if it's their loss or our gain, but someone's losing.
And are you active on Twitter now?
Not really. I do have a Twitter account. It's just Aaron Kowalski. I check it, but I don't really tweet much. Just I try to steer clear of social media because it seems like every time I get on Facebook or Twitter, I start some sort of firestorm. Like, I've got one where people are still commenting on from like 5 weeks ago, and it was something very simple. Does pineapple belong on a pizza? I said it was up to the person basically, you know, wanting the pizza.
Very fair. Middle of the road answer.
There's over 600 replies.
That's amazing.
Man. So you need to turn that into 600 YouTube views and you'll be somewhere.
Oh, yeah, there you go. There you go. So, but yeah, hopefully I'll get some videos going here once winter hits, because then I'll get some free time and...
That I love that thing. You know, I was reading a book. There's this really great book on it's a novel, but it's about the enclosure of the commons in like the 1600s in England, and it's called Harvest. And it basically goes into like we talked about this a little bit earlier, but the cyclical annual, like, you know, the winter is for repairing your shit and like having fun, mm-hmm. and you know, and then, you know, you work. That is something that really appeals to me. Like, I fucking hate working year round doing the same shit.
That's why historically you've always had your celebrations right at the end of harvest, you know, Thanksgiving's right at the end. And then for the solstice or Christmas, whatever that big holiday is, you know, you have a big feast, get the whole town together, the family, and yeah. Party out.
Going back to work after that's just so weird. But anyway, Aaron Kowalski, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it. And we will see you patrons on Wednesday.
See ya.
Thank you.